Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
Gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerer of death's construction. In the fields of bodies burning, machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, poisoning their brainwashed minds. Oh, Lord, yeah. Darkness world stops turning, ashes where the body's burning.
No more war pigs have the power. And as God has struck the hour, the day of judgment God is calling. On the knees the war pigs crawling, begging mercies for the sins. Satan laughing spreads his wings. Oh Lord, yeah.
Black Sabbath and War Pigs. I love that ending. That's incredible. I've never really listened to that before. I feel a bit strange. So that was from their second studio album, Paranoid, which was released in September 1970. Do you know, the more we play Black Sabbath, I'm actually really like loving their songs more. It's just like a whole new world opening up to me.
They are great songs, and Iommi, and I say this every time we play him, but he is the riff master. There's stuff in there that he does which is just iconic and great sound. And what I like about it as well, if you listen to a lot of that in the middle, there's that trade-off again with the bass, you know, the Geezer Butler thing, and he's doing like a Jack Bruce to Eric Clapton's, you know. You know, it's like that thing going on between the two of them, and there's a lot of interaction. And when you listen to the track itself in detail, you realise that even though the recording, it doesn't actually sound all that good recording, but it's great because the bass is a really odd sound. It's like clacking against the fretch. It's really toppy, you know. And he must have actually had it through a 4x12 in the studio. It was like really clacky, but no DI, really, really interesting. But when you listen to it together, it just sounds fantastic.
What are you doing talking about bass? That's my turf. Oi,
bass.
On the other side, Sunshine, six strings.
I'm sorry about that.
No, I know exactly what you mean. I get that. And I also, what I can't, you know when they say it's heavy metal? Okay, let's have a listen to this. All Music stated that this album, War Pigs, is one of the greatest and most influential heavy metal albums of all time, which defined the sound and style of heavy metal more than any other record in rock history.
Indeed.
And then you imagine heavy metal, And genres are really strange, and I don't really know, because it's like, you know, does every dish that's called a pie taste like a pie? No, they're all different. And I know the genres are saying what's in the pie kind of thing, but you've got this complete and utter space, and you've just got the hi-hat going, tick, tick,
yeah.
Tick, tick.
And I love that little lick. The war machine goes, he comes like, great. Like, and more fuzz, it's fuzz guitar again. Great. We love him. We love Iron. We love the whole band. They're great. And, you know, it was produced by Roger Bain and recorded at Regent Sound Studios and Island Studios in London. Now, Regent has a very interesting history because Regent Studios, it was taken over by the Barings family. I can't remember which one of them it was, but it was he worked in very in very aristocratic circles, loads of money, of course, Barings Bank.
Yeah.
So he started it, and it became, because he was like a socialite, it became very much the place to go. So Rolling Stones did some demos there, David Bowie did some demos there, Black Sabbath did the first two albums there, but I've had a look to find out what audio equipment was in there. I can't find anything about it, even in the massive and fantastic tome, the Great British Recording Studios by Howard Massey,
which I'm
in the middle of reading it right now.
You snuck off when we were playing that song and came back grinning like a Cheshire cat with book in hand going, look at this.
And there I was, I couldn't Secret find anything research. About it.
Really?
Yeah. So there we are. So I don't really know anything about the studio. I know Roger Bain produced it.
Yeah.
But you know, again, to me, it's all about the song, because the song, the lyric is a great lyric. It's a great melody, because you can, you know, it's a really great melody, the whole thing. And then Iommi does melodies in his with his guitar solos. They're not just whittering, you know, pentatonic things, you know. He's doing a lot of doubles, so it's beautiful playing, you know. And the rest of the band really come together, but without Ozzy's voice, it's just not complete.
It's weird you say that, you know, because I'm now of the opinion, and I'm getting to know the band better, and Black Sabbath is not just about Ozzy, it's a team, and I'm getting to understand and meet the guys, you know, and the other musicians as we play. So we know that. So, and the way all this happened as well, it was actually going to be called this track, Walpurgis. I don't even know how to pronounce it.
Right, okay.
Which is, and it was Geezer Butler was talking about that, because he wanted to write a song about
this. Most of the lyrics, didn't he, Geezer?
Yeah, I love that name, yeah. Geezer. It sounds so Geezer, slang, doesn't it?
Geezer Butler.
He was going to do like the satanic version of Christmas, which is when he's writing about that Satan isn't a spiritual thing, it's warmongers, and he was, you know, talking about the banks. The dreaded banks and the people running the world trying to get the working class to fight wars for them.
Yeah.
And anyway,
nothing's changed.
So that track changed its name from Walpurgis to War Pigs, and they were going to actually call the album itself War Pigs. But because Paranoid had done so well as a single, the record label thought that it would be easier to sell the album if they called the album Paranoid.
Wow.
So that's where that comes from. And the thing is, though, they didn't change the album artwork.
So this sounds like Spinal Tap, go on.
It is. So this is what Ozzy was saying. So what the F, he said, does a bloke dressed as a pig with a sword in his hand got to do with being paranoid? It's true, isn't it?
While My Guitar Gently Weeps, from the 1968 album, the White Album, aka The Beatles, by The Beatles, with Eric Clapton on guitar.
Eric.
Yeah. Bit of tension there. And, you know, my mate, Jeff Emmerich, who actually, I say his mate, I do know him on Facebook and stuff, and I've chatted with him and stuff. But anyway, he's he walked out of the sessions. And people said, why is Jeff Emmerich, the engineer, who was masterminded, really, because it wasn't really Sir George Martin that did all the interesting sounds and production. He did the arrangements and the orchestration and stuff and scoring stuff and work with harmonies. But the actual sound was created by the mighty Jeff Emmerich. And people said, how can you walk out on the Beatles? He said, it's easy. He said, the tensions, it was just too much for him. They come back from... There's a story here about the Maharishi, is it?
Yeah, they come back from some time studying transcendental meditation under Maharishi Mahesh Yogi in early 1968.
Better than teaching dentistry, anyway. Anyway.
Don't start. And the thing was, right, so George Harrison had been, like, really engrossed in exploring the sitar for a couple of years. So they got back into the studio and they weren't really all getting on. I think George was really, really obsessed and really on a course, a spiritual path. Mm. And it was at that time as well when Yoko Ono started coming and hanging out in the mm-hmm. studio. So things weren't great. And Ringo then subsequently walked out, didn't he? He left for a while. And it's just, so it's all that time and it's fractious. And the thing is that George didn't want to, apparently he didn't want to present his song to the band because of the way everything felt so bad, you know. And it's odd,
I'm glad
isn't
he did.
It? Yeah.
Because actually it's one of my favourite Beatles songs, even though it wasn't written by Lennon McCartney. Because I think it's got, you know, he'd obviously, you know, learnt a lot from the songwriting of probably the greatest songwriting duo ever in existence, ever, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
You know, classical people aside, but certainly popular music. And, you know, I think he felt a bit embarrassed. But Ken Scott took over as engineer in this, and I think he did a bloody good job, actually. It's a great, you know, it's a great sounding record. And when you compare this sound with Black Sabbath, you know, and everything I said about Black Sabbath earlier on about how great it was, this just is outstandingly recorded, isn't it? It's like, of course, they were very experienced. They were doing it all individually this time.
Yeah.
You know, most of the instruments were done. And the bass was done later.
It's now, you talk about the bass, because the bass feels to me, I can almost feel the roughness of the strings. It feels very choppy, very aggressive, very, there's like a real edge to, like a metal edge to the texture, and it's chopping away, that's what it's doing.
Yeah,
it is
really aggressive. And by this time, I think he changed to a Rickenbacker, that's why, 4001, I think he was using. And it did have a different sound. But apparently, he was so meticulous in these later albums, he used to do like virtually one note at a time, which is incredible, using tape, you know, trying to get it absolutely perfect.
It's a bit weird, isn't it? I know the story about when George Harrison and Eric Clapton were in a taxi or something in the car on the way into studio, and George says, "Hey, mate, do you fancy playing on this track or this song?" And he went, apparently Eric said, "I can't do that. Nobody ever plays on Beatles tracks," but he persuaded him to do it, even though he's not credited. So can you imagine waltzing in with Clapton with all this tension? You've got Jeff, you've got Ken coming in, you've got everything. And but what was quite interesting as well, just something that you have got me addicted to this kind of recording process now. You're a git. Because now I'm excited when I read things like this overdubbing session on the 3rd of September marked the first time that the Beatles had used an 8-track recording at EMI Studios. Now, to me, I understand now far more about what that, the impact of that, and how that would have affected their creative output.
Well, you know, and some people, I mean, I do not subscribe. Now, I'm ready for the emails here. Get ready, folks, for the emails. But I don't subscribe to using really more than, you know, 32, 40 recorded tracks. You know, when you're mixing, and we mix live, don't we? We mix live. Yeah. We don't do it in the box, i.e. we're using a computer. We use an old-fashioned mixing console with one, two or three people.
We feel it, don't we?
Yeah, one or two, three people actually working the faders, sending all the auxes, doing the echoes and everything. It's very organic, just like it used to be done in the 60s. You make mistakes. Sometimes they're good mistakes, sometimes they're bad mistakes, and you can't recreate them. You can't do a remix easily. But I think as time's gone on now, everybody's disappearing up their own backside trying to get everything perfect. Where if you've got less tracks, and I mean, we're talking 8 tracks. The Beatles was, you know, recorded, most of it was recorded on a 3-track recorder.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then they went up to 8-track. And it's incredible what they achieved by bouncing down. And it's all about, and I'm going to get on my high horse here, about committing to what you want the final thing to sound like in the middle. Because they used to bounce down because you had a small number of tracks that do the drums, for example, and bass on one track, and then you'll bounce that across to another track and add something else into it. So once you've added something into it, you can't go back. You can't just, you know,
so really it's
it.
Like you've got two separate tracks, and to free it, and say you've got three, so you've recorded on tracks one and two, what you'll do is you'll splice one and two together and put those two sounds onto the one tape, which frees up another channel. That's what basically it means.
Correct. Or do a live overdub as you're transferring it.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's really, really, but you've got to commit and you've got to understand the levels and the EQ and everything before you actually do it. And because of that, people had a really good idea of what it was going to sound like at the end. And you know, and that track, the Beatles, Gently Weeps, it's a great song, beautifully produced, greatly engineered by Ken Scott.
And George Harrison finally growing and putting his songs on the table and going, all right, lads, here you go. Yeah.
Captain said, "The lights down there, that's where we'll land." I saw a falling star burn up above the Las Vegas sands. It wasn't the one that you gave to me that night down south between the trailers. And ship I got the northern one to guide in the sailors. Oh, starboard, you've got the loving that I like. All right, turn this crazy bird around. I shouldn't have gone on this flight tonight. You got the touch so gentle and sweet, but you got that look so critical. Now I can't talk to you, baby, I get so weak. Sometimes I think love is just musical. Up there's the heavens, down there's the town. Blackness everywhere and little light shine. Oh, darkness, blackness, dragging me down. Come on, light the candle in this poor heart of mine. Oh, star bright, you got the loving that I like. All right, turn this crazy bird around. I shouldn't have got on. Sweet champagne, got the headphones up high. Can't numb you out, can't drum you out of my mind. They're playing goodbye, baby, baby, goodbye. Ooh, love is fine. Up go the flaps, down go the wheels. I hope you got your heat turned on, baby. I hope they finally fixed your automobile. Hope it's better when we meet again, baby. Star bright, you got the love that I like. All right, turn this crazy bird around. Shouldn't have gone on this flight tonight.
Joni Mitchell. And this Flight Tonight, taken from her fourth studio album, Blue. It was released in June 1971.
Recorded at A&M Studios in Los Angeles.
Really, honey?
Yeah, she produced it. And it's littered with stars, this record. I mean, not only is it, I mean, in my opinion, and again, Trouble Ahead, probably one of the greatest acoustic albums ever been recorded. I think she's a great songwriter. I know you don't particularly like her voice, but...
Wait, nah.
No?
True.
It's true, it is true. There you are, I know, that's right. But I do, and I think the songs themselves are absolutely marvellous. But it was engineered by a guy called Henry Louis, who was introduced to them. To her, I should say, by Crosby, Stills and Nash. And he went on later on to work with Neil Young. And most importantly, because we're going to be playing a track very shortly from this record, Famous Blue Raincoat by Jennifer Warnes.
Oh.
It was produced by George Massenberg. Incredible production. And it's songs of Leonard Cohen sung by Jennifer Warnes. Really, it sounds really dodgy, but we've got some tracks later on in the shows. Amazing. Anyway, but coming back to this.
To Joni Mitchell hanging out at Laurel Canyon.
Yeah. What a hell of a thing. Well, Stephen Stills is on it. James Taylor. Sneaky Pete Cleano, the pedal steel player. Russ Kunkel on drums. And, like, these are, like, you know, real big hitters. But, of course, Command Do She Wanted on the record. But I think it's marvellous. And the guitar playing on that's really good as well. Lovely.
I don't really listen to Joni Mitchell, and I feel that I wanted to meet her in a place that would connect. And I think what's happened is that when I was younger, and I'm an alto, I think I've talked about this before, but, you know, the soprano shrill doesn't really appeal to me. I can't emotionally connect to music when somebody sings with that shrill tonal quality. And I've always really been put off by that.
You don't like Joan Baez either, do you?
No, not really. She's overly vibrato for me as well. Yeah. So I was like, but I do respect Joni Mitchell completely. And I know that if I met her, I'd love her, you know? And I think that sometimes I just need another... It's like I found out that she started off playing ukulele, would you believe?
Blimey.
But the thing is,
glad
she
got over it.
She had polio when she was a child, you know.
No.
So she had real problems getting some chord shapes. So what she used to do was she'd create her own tunings and create her own chord shapes because her fingers weren't working as well.
Ah.
And that's what happened. It gave her a unique approach and a unique sound, and she didn't actually. And she was quite a free thinker. She wasn't really into formal education in that respect. And she was an artist. She did a lot of artwork for her own albums. So you can see now a little bit more. There's a bit more of a rounded picture of her and the reason why. I mean, she had such a tough life, and it kind of melted my heart when I was reading about. And I don't really want to talk about that because I know her songs. She says her songs are kind of the voice of what she went through, you know, and she's given that as a gift to us, which is beautiful. So I think today what I've decided is that I need to, but not force myself, but I need to just, I am more soft-hearted towards her now. I'm trying to not just take the tonal quality of her voice as something to be put off by. I want to
It's in her vinyl collection. I think we might stick it on tomorrow again.
I keep trying to play it. And, you know, as in when we do play it, I try to get into it, but need to give it time.
Yeah. But the reason why we're playing this song is very interesting is that our mate, Dave Swindells, the other week, who does our sounds for us, he just put on the Nazareth version of this. And actually, I didn't know. I sort of got, of course, I'd heard the Joni Mitchell version, but it just didn't click that Nazareth had covered it. And it was like an amazing thing. And obviously, I know the Nazareth version, but the two songs, even though they're actually very similar in production, I just didn't get it because I listened to Joni Mitchell and Blue, and I thought, all right, okay, that's cool. And then I listened to Nazareth, and I thought, wow, it's a completely different sort of thing. So anyway, so there we go. Nazareth, This Flight Tonight, and Joni Mitchell, This Flight Tonight. I think the Joni Mitchell one is far better.
And when you're dead, you're done. So let the good times roll. Whoa, let them roll. I don't care if you're young or old. Get yourself together, let the good time roll, baby. Don't sit there mumbling, talking trash. If you want to have a ball, you gotta go out and spend some cash. And let the good time roll, baby. Whoa, let them roll now. I don't care if you're young or old. You ought to get together and let the good time roll, baby. Yeah. In town. Got a dollar and a quarter and I'm just riding the clock. But don't let no female play me cheap. I got 50 cents more than I'm gonna keep. So let the good times roll out. Whoa, let them roll, baby. I don't care if you're young or old. Get yourself together, let the good time roll, baby. No matter whether, rainy weather, if you want to fall, you gotta get yourself together. Oh, get yourself under control. Oh, let the good times roll.
You're listening to The Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And that was Let the Good Times Roll from the sixth studio album, The Genius of Ray Charles, released in October 1959 on Atlantic Records, engineered by Tom Dowd.
Tom!
Yeah,
we love Tom Dowd.
You know, if you don't know who he is, we did a podcast ages ago now on Tom Dowd.
Oh, he's fantastic.
Series. So if you want to go back and listen to that, it tells you all about him, and we go into great depths with it.
You have to watch it a few times because it's so intense, and he talks quickly.
But yeah, that's the video.
Yeah, that's the documentary.
That's right.
Oh, yeah, not the actual podcast. So I just went straight to that.
Good, it's no problem.
I just got a bit emotional about Tom, really, then, because he's been quite an inspiration for me.
Marvellous. But, of course, it was produced by Jerry Wexler and Neshu Eritgun. I always get his
name. Can I do it, please? Say Jerry Wexler.
Yes, Jerry Wexler.
It's a hit. Print it. That's our Jerry Wexler impersonation. Yeah, and again, do one more time. Come on, Jerry Wexler.
Jerry Wexler.
It's a hit. Print it.
That is one of his most famous expressions. It's in that Tom Dowd documentary, isn't it?
That was a bit overindulgent, but can you imagine these guys in that day, in those days, they literally weren't, they were just going, yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, because what happened is Tom Dowd, I think he was, just very briefly, he was recording something down at Muscle Shoals, I think, sent the acetate, it was the acetate, up to Jerry Wexler in New York, of course, and obviously had to get driven up like a courier or whatever, you know? And he spoke to him on the phone, and that's what he said. He said, what do you think of the record? He went, it's hit, print it. And that was it. Great. And they just produced all these records. Fantastic. But a giant of the audio industry, Jerry Wexler and Atlantic, because they were some of the first people to actually record commercially and put out really commercially and push black music.
Yeah.
Indeed. And, you know, they were absolutely instrumental of that. And, of course, later on, they signed Led Zeppelin. After Peter Grant went round all tooled up, I suspect, and said, you need to sign him up. But anyway, back to Ray Charles.
Yes.
What I love about that, just from a recording point of view again, is that the vocal is buried in the audience because you can hardly hear him.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in bits of it. And he's the star, you know. But, of course, they were recording it all together. And in 1959, they probably had one mic. So what they were doing is asking the bass player just to move back a little bit and put the horns over in that corner out of the way because they're too loud. And then the piano and everything, getting nice and close. You know, so it's an amazing, an amazing process.
Do you know what I really love, right? Okay, there are these people that we play and I presume... And we presume that we know things about them. So we go, Ray Charles, you know about Ray Charles. Most people do. So I was just trying to think today as well of something that I could really connect to about him as a person. And sometimes that takes you back to your childhood. And what I love about him is that he was really curious as a child. And he was at Willie Pittman's Red Wing Cafe. And he was like age 3. And he used to see Willie play the piano, the Boogie Woogie. Do you remember that from the film?
I do.
And he was so inspired by the piano that Willie taught him how to play. And what I love about that, and I know he lost his sight at 7, but Willie used to let his mum live there and him in the cafe when they didn't have enough money. So, you know, I love the fact you've got this real community. You've got a guy with a piano in this bar and he teaches a young kid to play piano. And, you know... At that point, when you've got that little one sat on the stool next to you and you're showing them chords and stuff, you have no idea what you've just sparked off and what adventure that man was going to go on.
Incredible. And just finally, I'd like to just say that I dedicate that to John O'Gollo. Okay, he used to sing that, the late, great giant of the Manx music industry, John O'Gollo, who passed away, and he used to sing that very song.
Thank you.
because we've ended as lovers. Jeff Beck.
Well, Control. That's all I can say about that. He's probably the greatest British guitar player, rock and roll guitar player, that's ever been. Fantastic. His use of his tremolo on that, his sound, his dynamics, his charisma, his playing has charisma. You can tell it's him. I personally think this album, it's a live album recorded at Ronnie Scott's, is some of his finest actual recordings. I love him live. He's just great, you know. I think sometimes he goes over the top and gets a bit sort of into himself a bit, but this is magnificent. And I think this particular performance is tempered by the most magnificent bass playing by the very young at the time, Tal Wolkenfeld. Because the solo in that, when I saw it, I went, holy mother of poo.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
I've never heard you say that before, but it's true.
Well, I was going to say something else, but I realised I've got to keep it clean. But it's true. It's a great solo, melodic, great tone. You know, she looked great when she was playing it. She's totally absorbed into the whole. Yeah, and the joy.
Solo, you could see her, and what I loved is that I was playing and she's gone, she's disappeared, nobody else exists in the room, she's just in some this land, and you're hearing her go on this adventure, and she stops, she looks up and gives you this big grin.
Yeah, Jeff Beck actually looks amazed on the other side of the stage, and of course it's rooted in my favourite drummer of all time.
Who's that?
Vinnie Clutter.
I know.
And magnificent. Now, we talk about drum sounds here, and I know his drum sound here is very sort of, it's quite open and it's got all that bend in the toms. And you know, normally I don't like that sort of thing, but I prefer the more traditional sound of like the 65, 75 sort of drum sounds, that, you know, more natural sound. But this is the tuning of his drums and his breaks, and the whole record is playing is faultless, faultless. And you think and he's coming out, he'll come out of a break and he'll come do do but he go do do do, and you think, oh, he's not gonna go back in time, he's not gonna come back in time, and it seems to go up the all out of time, but he's thinking in time signatures in these breaks that just people just don't think in, and then he comes in bang on, and you know, and Tal and him on this album is amazing. We don't have it on vinyl, it don't exist on vinyl, sadly, so this is one of the rare occasions that we've played something.
I've got a question for you then. So I was thinking about Jeff Beck, and I know that I don't really know him, and I'm getting to know him because obviously you know him, and I know he's an English rock guitarist. He's one of three noted guitarists played with the Yardbirds. Mm-hmm. But what I was thinking of today was, why has most of his output, besides a certain song, been instrumental?
Well, he's not a great singer. You know, High or Silver Lining sort of proved that, really. I think
but
it,
he
I
could
didn't
work
like
with, I know he's. No, I guess so. I think, no, I don't know what it is. No, because that doesn't mean to say he has to sing, but I know he plays on other people's albums, and I know he's a great session player, and the list is ridiculous. I mean, it's crazy the amount of people he's played with and of such a great calibre of all different styles and genres. Yep. But I just wonder why his own stuff, he hasn't got other people singing. But then other people say there are no need for lyrics with the way he plays. His language is his guitar. That's it.
Well, he's an instrumentalist now. I think that's what he is. And you know, I mean, he's got a good lifestyle. He's done very well financially from what he's done because he's a genius. He really is a genius. There was Andy Powell, Wishbone Ash, a mate of ours, and he saw him the other week and he posted something on Facebook. He posted like a 20-second clip. And he said, this is blues guitar, not as we know it. And he was playing, Jeff Beck's playing a blues, but it was amazing. It wasn't out there. It wasn't very jazz rocky. It wasn't like Robin Ford or Matt Scofield or any of those sort of guys, or moving further out towards jazz, you know, Larry Cantlin, whatever, and further. But it was using exactly the same notes that everybody else uses. That
this is the weird thing.
It sounded incredible. And his use of tremolo and his expression is a delight as a guitar player.
Yeah.
What is it good for?
Absolutely
nothing.
Uh-huh. sail again, y'all. Whoa. Look out.
What is it good for?
Absolutely.
Now
listen to me. Oh, whoa. I despise costing me destruction of innocent lives. Warm me his tears, 10,000 of mothers I have. When their sons go out to fight and lose their. To me.
Whoa.
It ain't nothing but a heartbreaker.
Whoa.
I got one friend, that's the Undertaker. To me.
War, Edwin Starr, a counterculture era song written by Norman Whitfield and Barrett Strong, great name, for the Motown label in 1969.
It went to number one on the Billboard Hot 100 for 3 weeks. It was in the chart at the top spot in 1970. That's pretty good. Do you know what it knocked off the top spot?
Go on.
I wanna make it with you.
No.
Yep, Brad. Yeah. But what's interesting about this song as well is that it was originally recorded with the Temptations doing the vocals.
Right.
And it's obviously an anti-Vietnam song.
That's right.
And the record label didn't want to release it. And the album did so well and people were writing and said, release it as a single, we love this song. And they thought, oh no, you know, we're going to offend the Temptations' more conservative audience. So they actually, Edwin Starr, who'd just been... Gordy had just bought out his label, Tic Tac, that he was signed to.
Okay.
Came on board and he re-recorded the lead vocal of this song.
No.
And they released it as a single. Yep. And it launched his career big star.
Well, it would do. One of the greatest anti-war songs ever.
Yeah.
I think. And I love Barry Gordy, of course. You know, the production, it's all going on there. There's congas, there's brass, there's everything. it's like the whole of, you know, the whole of Motor City. Is on that record, you know. It's incredible. I love it because when you hear the detail on cans, you hear it and your little horns go and all that. So it's great, great production, lovely.
And great song as well.
Fantastic song, yeah.
But you know it's coming to the end of the show now.
No.
And we want to talk about the next band as well. So thank you so much for joining us for the Supertone Show this week. You can contact us on Facebook and Twitter. It's at Susie and Simon, that's S-U-Z-Y.
And the show is available on Mixcloud, Spotify, iTunes and iHeartRadio.
Okay.
But the last track.
It's your T-shirt. You've not worn that for absolute bonkers years. And you're wearing the T-shirt of this band.
Indeed. Joy Division. That's right. Because the first album, Unknown Pleasures, which the Factory didn't release any singles from this, from Oh No Pleasures at all. And what we're going to play is a song called Transmission that was actually recorded as a demo first and then released as a single following a re-record with a faster tempo, I believe, yep, later on. But it was produced by the mighty Martin Hannett from Manchester. Now, this guy is an absolute legend in the fact that he's really, really, you know, he's really, really instrumental in the whole music scene in Manchester. They were using a Helios console at Strawberry Studios, which I actually was, I used to do a lot of recording Strawberry sessions stuff, all sort of things in Strawberry over the years, and I know it really well. And recently, Chris Hewitt, who's a mate of mine, who has this vintage equipment place in Rochdale, he rents out a lot of vintage equipment to film sets and stuff, and he's got a great collection, marvellous, who also was one of the guys behind Deeply Veiled Festival, right? He actually recreated the studio recently as like a publicity thing, which I thought was a great thing.
Fantastic.
You know? Yeah, we couldn't get there because we were over here, but, you know, great.
So what was it about Joy Division? This is my question. That really connected with people of that time, because they were formed in Salford in 1976. Now, I was in Salford. I went to college there in 1990. You went to Salford Uni. So it's like, what happened there? What is it? It's just, they're described as kind of this post-punk band.
Well, it was, you know, they were like a group of very unusual individuals from Macclesfield. You know, the film, incidentally, about Ian Curtis's life is absolutely fantastic, and it's a must-watch.
The Anton Corbijn film we watch, oh, beautiful.
Genius yeah, film, such a sad thing, but a great representation, I think, what went on. You know, because I knew Tony in Manchester because, you know, it was all part of...
Tony Wilson, Factory is. Records. Yeah.
And also the manager and all the sort of stuff. I knew all these guys. And actually, that film was a very good representation of these people and what went on, you know?
Because Tony Wilson didn't get anyone to sign contracts, did he? But they made him, didn't they make him sign in blood or something?
He did, he signed it in blood, yeah, because he didn't want to do it. And there was the, oh my goodness, because they used to own the Hacienda and all that, and oh my God, I spent some time in that as well. So it was a great time in Manchester, but they, you know, they were very eclectic individuals, and they've always gone on to done great things. And after Ian Curtis died, of course, they released great things like Blue Monday. Anyway, see you next time.